welcome to another episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde, the guy behind the Fretboard Journal magazine. Umpteen podcasts. We have a whole network of them, in case you don't know. One for, I think, every day of the week at this point. And now our annual Guitar Geek Gathering called the Fretboard Summit. You are hearing John Rauhaus playing in the background as always. This week's podcast is a truly cool one. Our Fretboard Summit was last month in Chicago. And for folks who have no idea what this thing is, it's a gathering. You're all invited. We're doing another one next year, August 22nd to 24th, 2024, where we take over the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago and fill it with all sorts of stuff we think like-minded guitar fanatics, gear fanatics would enjoy. There are all these brands displaying their wares. You can try stuff out. You can buy stuff. There are two or three workshops going at any given hour. History lessons on gear, how-tos, you name it. There are jam rooms. There was a room just for fans of our Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. There was a science fair where people could just show off the wacky creations that they decided to bring to the summit. We had a game show hosted by this week's podcast interviewer, Josh Scott. We had incredible concerts. Everybody was pretty floored by the whole thing. I know I was. And this was one of the sessions that took place. I heard that Taylor Guitars was coming to the summit. I knew that Bob Taylor and Andy Powers of Taylor Guitars were going to be there. I knew that Andy was going to be bringing some of the new electric guitars that he has just launched, the Powers Electric Company. This is sort of an offshoot brand of Taylor Guitars. As if Andy doesn't have enough on his plate running Taylor Guitars, he decided to create a whole second line called Powers Electric. I know that most of you out there probably haven't touched these guitars yet. They've sent their preferred dealers a few at a time. And when I heard that Andy was going to be there with these guitars, I thought it was high time that we interviewed him again. We've interviewed him a bunch on this podcast already. But I also knew that I was overextended and I wasn't going to interview him because I was about 50 yards away helping Bill Frisell out with his Bill Frisell guitar orchestra that anyone could join. So I did the thing I rarely do. I delegated, and I delegated to one of the music world's great authorities, most passionate people around, Josh Scott of JHS Pedals. Josh was there, and Josh interviewed Andy about everything, creativity, working at Taylor, life before Taylor, these electric guitars. I don't think Josh and Andy had met in person before this gathering, but in one of those weird bits of synchronicity that happened all weekend long because our community is so tight-knit and so cool, Josh knew Drew Shirley of the band Switchfoot really well, and Drew's been helping Andy out. So you're going to hear Andy and Drew in this conversation with Josh Scott. It's a pretty cool thing. I hope you enjoy it. I do just want to say before we start, a huge thanks to Josh Scott, not only for coming to the Fretboard Summit and being a part of it and encouraging me to do this wacky event and the magazine and all that I do. Like me, he loves the history of the world of guitars. He's celebrating it. He is celebrating other brands beyond his own. It's such a unique thing, and I don't take it for granted, and I don't think any of you should as well. He just did that whole documentary on Ross Pedals, and I know he relaunched the brand, but the documentary is like a real documentary that you could just watch to learn a little bit about a piece of gear. It also covers custom amps, if anybody remembers those tuck and roll custom amps. Josh is just constantly doing stuff like this. He's constantly celebrating this little universe. I'm so grateful he's in our corner helping us out with the summit. He's got even wackier plans for 2024's summit. I hope we can pull them off. It's a cool thing. Thank you, Josh, for being a part of the Fretboard Journal community. Some minor housekeeping. We have a Patreon for this show. If you want to support me, if you like that I do all these interviews, if you like that I share so much behind-the-scenes content from here, you should go to our Patreon. I'll include a link in the show notes. You can support all that I do. Whether or not you get the magazine, it helps me out a ton. We have a brand new 53rd issue of the Fretboard Journal going to press very soon. Our dear friend Ben Harper is in this issue. I did that interview. This issue has such a crazy, cool array of stories, some really cool historical guitars. Fran Blanche from Frantone is in this issue. We've got jazz coverage. We've got all, I mean, we cover everything. Our issues are always really eclectic. This one is super eclectic in a really good way. I hope you are a subscriber. If you are not yet, go to fretboardjournal.com, click on that subscribe button. You'll be able to reserve your copy. They do sell out. Our print edition sells out. We also have the discounted digital subscription if you want to go that route. I know I've said it before, I'll say it again. We are truly a reader-supported and listener-supported endeavor. Even the brands that support us, that sponsor us, they all started out as Fretboard Journal readers, and they just love what we do, and they want to be in our magazine, and we want to celebrate them. A few of the brands supporting this very episode that you're about to listen to are the following. Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar here in Seattle, Washington, one of the great vintage instrument stores. Every time I go in there, I'm floored by all that they have, electric and acoustic. They get these rad Fender Japanese market only guitars. I don't know how they get them, but they get them. They are so cool and unique. They have an incredible array of amps and synths and all points in between. Check out Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. Follow them on Instagram. You will not be disappointed. Our friends at Peghead Nation have one of the coolest music instruction portals around. I'm taking the Maybelle Carter guitar class that just launched. I sound nothing like Maybelle Carter, but I'm keeping at it, and you can too. You can get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code FRETBOARD when you check out. Isotope just released an update to their mastering suite, Ozone 11, and also to their incredible vocal software, Nectar 4. We use Isotope around here. We clean up a lot of crummy sounding audio with some of their software. I know you'll love them. You can get their software at isotope.com, and if you use the discount code FRET10, you'll get 10% off. Last but not least, our friends at Stringjoy Strings are letting you all save 10% off on your first order at stringjoy.com. with the promo code FRETBOARD. I know a bunch of you out there have been trying them out. I've been getting the rave reviews. They are so cool. Keep them coming. Let me know. podcast@fretboardjournal.com. And now we've got Josh Scott of JHS Pedals interviewing Andy Powers just for you all, live from the Fretboard Summit. I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks for coming out.
Yeah.
So this is Drew Shirley. We've been friends for almost 15 years, something like that, close to it. And then we're new acquaintances, and I love what you do. This is Andy. So thanks for coming. And I guess the best thing to do here is to start.
Yeah. At the beginning. We'll start at the beginning.
Yeah. So I've checked out your guitars. I've purposely not played one yet. I'm going to play one later.
The electric guitars?
Yeah.
Okay.
The electric.
I've got a lot of guitars.
Yeah.
So yeah, you do. Yeah. The electric guitars. You have a really vast breadth of touch in the guitar world, between electric, acoustic, tons of experience. And I think it'd be fun to talk to you in some capacity about like innovation and history of guitar and some of this, but also I think people would love to hear like a basic premise of where you're at and how you got there. I think one of the things about creative people is that path. The process is more interesting than the product for most people. So what's the process? Like, how did you get here to this place where you've had your hand in the guitar world in such a broad way?
You know, that's an interesting question, because in a way, what you presented there was two different things, that it's broad and that it has a path. And for me, the reason that it was broad is because I didn't really have a path, right? They're kind of overlaid on top of each other. Because when I was a kid, I mean, my parents play some music. They both like it. We always listen to a lot of music, but my dad's a carpenter, so I was kind of around woodworking. And I was a completely clueless, naive kid, just like everybody else. I mean, I was like 7 or 8 years old. My parents didn't really ever have much money, because my dad's a carpenter. And he would bring home scraps of wood, and I'd make stuff out of it. That was my deal.
What's some of the first things?
I'd make little surfboards. I'd make skateboards. I'd make whatever. You know, whatever the size of piece of wood it was going to turn into something. And one day he brought home a bigger piece. He was building a mantle at somebody's house. So he brought home this big piece. I'm like, oh, I'm going to make a guitar. That's a big chunk. And I didn't know how to make a guitar. I just knew that I liked guitars, and we had one, and that was a really cool thing. I liked the shapes, and my parents were funny. They still are. They're great people. but they had all these family friends, and my parents were some of the only people amongst their friends that had a house. We lived close to the water and up in Oceanside. And so every weekend they'd have all these people over, and some of them were commercial fishermen. Some of them are plumbers and electricians and all these kinds of things, but everybody played some guitar. And so they'd bring somebody had a mandolin. My dad played some mandolin, and they'd pass these things around. And I thought it was like the coolest thing ever, because that was what was normal to me. There'd be a couple of guys cutting up big fish in the backyard, and everybody passing guitars around and singing these songs, playing the same three chords. And I just thought that was like the coolest thing.
So where was the process for you where, there's a group of people, a lot of people at this event, you're a creative type, a mm-hmm. maker of melody and music, and then you actually make a thing involved with that. So it's like right. two makings. Where right. did that start for you?
And so I tried to build this guitar, and it blew up into 1,000 pieces. Like, so I was clueless. I
mean, blew up as in.
Yeah, define just blew up.
Well, I figured out how to make it hollow. I didn't know that there was supposed to be anything inside. I had 6 mismatched tuning keys that I begged from a music shop. I had a used set of guitar strings. I didn't know that things like fret wire is actually fret wire. And so I took a bunch of nails, cut the points off, cut the heads off, glued those into little channels.
Sweet.
It was frets, yeah. Kinda. I mean, I was a kid. I didn't know what I was doing. But I literally went to like tighten the strings up. And the thing just like ripped into pieces. It wasn't like a little like, oh, it's bending. It was like a, oh my God.
Are you okay?
Well, yeah. It was like literally went explosive style. And that kind of hooked me on it.
Oh, the chaos.
It was like that was like a firecracker. Yeah. That was kind of cool. Like is. Probably once I stopped crying about it, I was like, that was actually pretty exciting.
So how old were you?
I was like, maybe 7-8 years old, something like that.
Oh,
I was a kid.
It's really young. Okay.
Like I was
right
clueless.
On. Right on.
Okay. So the more I got into guitar, that cluelessness is what led to a lot of things, because I didn't know how to say no. Somebody would bring it would be like a family friend. They'd go, oh, you're into guitars. Could you fix this guitar? Sure. I didn't know if I could or not, but they'd bring their broken guitar over. I'd look at it and go, how am I going to, well, that part cracked apart. I could glue it back together. This part, I think it should work this way. Oh yeah, that worked better. And so it kind of started that way. And because of that, it was, I ended up starting this little company where I was doing repairs for all the local music shops. I'd do restorations. I'd build new instruments for people, but it would come in any way, shape or form. So it might be an electric guitar, it might be an archtop, it might be a mandolin or a ukulele or an old lap steel or a dobro or a banjo or whatever it might be. And I would just say yes to it. But because it was so like all over the place from any era, any age, it started accumulating this crossover sort of thing. Go, oh, flat top guitar. Sure, I can do this, but I want to borrow a little of this setup kind of work that I'm doing on these Les Pauls over here, because I want this flat top to play like that. I want the frets on this to feel like the frets on that. And actually, this has some other things, and this would be cool if you could. And so it turned into a crossover kind of a thing, environment, because I didn't know to specialize in one thing.
Yeah, I relate. I've caught myself saying, I got where I ended up because no one told me not to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's totally it.
Because I didn't know to pay taxes. Like,
I got a funny story about that if you want.
Like, that's the business side. And then the other side is like, recorded. No one said that I couldn't etch a board this way for a fuzz or like whatever.
Yeah.
No one said I couldn't take a Bucket Brigade chip and do the other thing that it was all self. And we talked a little bit earlier this morning. We kind of hit on, there's this need. I am a strong believer with creative endeavors and creative people, songwriting or making or whatever, movie making, anything. We're a society that we're in. Are we losing the ability to wander? Like there's a thing to wandering leads to places you don't know exist. And if you're looking for innovation, you have to find yourself where you didn't know you could go. And there's this thing about your story that hits on that. You're just having fun. And the borders aren't there.
Yeah, there's no borders because nobody's there to tell you you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong. You just start doing things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating. So you have these milestones. Right. I don't know you well at all. Yeah, I'm going to know you. I feel like we're going to hit it off. Similar personalities. I'm interested because I'm learning about you, just like a lot of viewers and people in here will. I feel like you have these milestones that are pretty apparent. There's Bob Taylor enters into the picture. Let's talk a little bit more about the BT.
Well, I became a small business when I was maybe, I can't remember if I was 12 or 13 because I got in trouble with the IRS.
So you started your first business at 12 or 13?
Right. Okay. Because I got a letter. I was doing repairs for a bunch of local music shops. They didn't have woodworking capabilities. I could fix stuff. So they'd call my mom and dad, leave a message.
That's amazing.
And then my mom or my dad would drive me around to all the shops. We'd pick up all the guitars in the station wagon. And then I'd bring them home. I'd fix them all. Next week, I'd make the circlet again, drop them all off. Huh. And nice.
I need to tell my 12-year-old this.
I don't know. I'd recommend it.
Yeah.
You probably get Child Protective Services called on you now.
Oh, man.
And so I got a letter from the IRS. And it's far enough in my rearview mirror that I can laugh at it now. I was totally ashamed of it for the longest time. Because I didn't really know a thing about making a business out of something. So I got this letter, and I ran in the house, showed it to my parents. I'm like, what does this mean? My dad started laughing. He goes, it means you made too much money and somebody noticed. And so I went out to the county recorder's office. You know, there's this person sitting at that little high counter.
Like, and a 13-year-old walks up.
What should I do with this? The guy's looking at it, looking at letter, looking at me, talks to the supervisor, talks to a couple other people, and then goes, slides it back at me, goes, I don't know what to tell you, kid. You got yourself in trouble. You're not legally old enough to work, but you got to figure out how to pay, like incorporate or something, pay this tax bill.
Oh my gosh.
And so I figured out a little workaround. They go, oh, this form doesn't actually have the fill in your age line on it, so I could do this and kind of sneak my way in.
It's amazing. So let's so wild.
Yeah, I'm done being embarrassed about it.
Oh, I feel like it's beautiful. I mean, embracing I didn't know what I was doing. I think it's so valuable to other people. No one, everyone's faking it, and no one knows what they're doing to some extent.
That's a good point.
Especially when you're starting a thing.
Oh yeah, and I had at the same time I had some musician friends who were hugely influential. Like I owe a huge debt to. There's a great musician named John Jorgensen. Great player, great electric guitar player, amazing clarinet player, really cool gypsy jazz, like kind of every instrument. He's shamefully good. I fell in with him when I was probably about that age, and he taught me so much just by letting me tag along with him. If he was playing open, he was living in LA at the time, and sometimes he'd call my mom and dad and go like, okay, this is a pretty open session. Come up, just watch how we do this. And he told me,
that's so valuable.
He told me, he goes, learn to play everything that you can, every style of music, any instrument, because it's all valuable. It's all going to influence the other stuff. And that's kind of where some of the magic comes from. He explicitly said, learn a bunch of instruments, learn a bunch of different styles of music, know this stuff because it'll make you a better player.
There's a writer I really love. I think I don't know the title of the book. He has a bunch of books, but there's this principle called the adjacent possible. Have you heard of this?
Not in that phrase.
He defines innovation and moving forward of ideas through the term the adjacent possible. So we all in society, we're kind of in school and we're handed a history book and we're told Edison invented the light bulb. Well, yeah. But what happened is the thing before him that was adjacent to him gave him the new possibility for the next
totally.
Step.
Totally. That's totally right.
The creative wandering, learn every genre, is how you end up being original. Because right. you gather everything and you cull it and edit it and you synthesize it. And
right.
So in your process, that has been a huge...
Right. That's been a big thing.
Like, it's when you see a guitar player and they say, I only play country. It's like, there's going to be problems with that because that's fine. But if you're wanting to pass through the creative boundaries, you got to borrow from the possible around you.
And you got to know where that came from. If you only want to play country, where did that country come from?
Yeah.
I mean, there was a psychologist back in the, I want to say 50s and 60s named Mendoff. There was a movement towards studying like the essence of creativity. What is that? Trying to define it. I think he came probably the nearest I've ever heard, which is he was playing with an idea called dissociative memory.
Okay.
Okay. But he defined creativity as the formation of a relationship between two previously unrelated ideas.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. That's probably pretty close.
Yeah.
Because you're creating some sort of link. It's like the space in between. Well, this exists and this exists. And at first glance, maybe they don't relate to each other, but maybe they do. Maybe they do. I could make them.
Yeah, it's a trail of the next thing butts to the next thing.
Yeah.
You don't have the internet without a computer. You don't have a computer without a transistor. You don't have a transistor without the tube. You don't have that. And you can just, everything makes the next thing possible. So everything comes from everything before it. And there is no light bulb moment.
No, and that's true for every sort of, like, the history of invention. I've always thought that, like, here in the U.S., our greatest asset was the garage. Because you look at where all the kinds of cool things that came out of garages somewhere, you go, man, if I had to start as a business, a lot of things would never have started. I can't afford overhead. I can't afford a second electric bill. I can't afford employees. I can't afford all that stuff. But I got this garage or this barn, and I've been trying this thing. I got an idea. Mm-hmm. That's where almost all the cool stuff comes from, right? Yeah. And so you look at the history of instruments, and it's always been that way. It's always been, well, a musician's asking for this. Sure, I'll try. You try this thing. A musician goes, oh, well, now that I have this, I could X, Y, and Z. And it becomes like this neat two-way street of development of going, well, we don't know where this ends, but we're having a lot of fun and we're making some cool things in the process. Yeah. So great.
So we'll hold this thought because I want to come back around to it. So here we have you. You grow up. You're making skateboards and stuff. You start a business. You get in trouble with the IRS. You're 13. Let's do the montage movie scene from that to Taylor.
I was playing a lot of music. I had I was a homeschooled kid.
Okay.
So I had a lot of free time to do stuff because I learned really quick. I can get all my schoolwork done.
Efficiency.
A short amount of time. Let's get on with the cool stuff that comes after that. And so I finished high school when I was very young. Started in a college because I had a scholarship.
14?
Oh, I was
14 and a half.
I think I was 15 or I just turned 16 when I finished high school. And I started studying at one of the local colleges. I knew a bunch of guys who were great music teachers there. And I went to UCSD because I had a scholarship to study some music. And I knew a bunch of those guys. So I'd always just been playing music, playing on people's records, playing in bands, and building instruments, repairing instruments. So even throughout my college years, we'll call it, it was mostly building and selling instruments to professors, classmates, musicians, just kind of all the while. I was telling somebody earlier this morning, I had a near panic attack when I graduated because all my musician friends were going, well, I'm going to go get a job. I got a teaching gig. I got and I go, oh my gosh, I got to go get a job. What am I going to do? I've got like a 3-year waiting list. I am so screwed right now. I've taken deposits from all these great players. They're all waiting for me to build an instrument. I can't go get a job.
Wait a minute.
And I went, wait.
I have a job.
Wait a minute. All my bills are paid. That's not really a problem. The IRS thinks that I've been in business for more than 10 years now. Yeah. I guess that's not a problem. I love doing this. I'll just do this instead of a job. I'll pretend that it's a job. And so I did that because it worked great. I loved it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a really nice way to provide for my wife and our eventual kids. And I was surfing a lot, playing a lot of music. I didn't have to go around touring, which was great. Because I really liked being in my workshop. I'd make records with people. That was a lot of fun. And I thought that was just, like, the coolest thing. Kind of lived and worked like Geppetto in a workshop.
Yeah. So how do you end up with Taylor? From that.
Bob and I had met when I was still a teenager because San Diego's small and there's not many guitar makers there. We were sitting next to each other at a concert, a Harvey Reed concert. Actually, he was doing a little thing. He's kind of a troubadour, singer-songwriter sort of player. And I had, I can't remember if it was a mandolin or a uke or something that I'd built. He looked at it, he goes, well, look me up if you ever need a job. I go, well, thanks, but no thanks. And I guess when I was in my mid or late 20s, I was playing with Jason Mraz quite a bit at the time. Mm-hmm. He had started to come into some success with his songs. And we were doing a duo kind of thing, just when we were wanted to have some fun. And so we ended up playing at a NAMM booth together. And Bob and I got reacquainted and started chatting and invited me and another friend, Pepe Romero Jr., right, over, who go like, well, we're the only three guitar makers in San Diego that we could name. We got to at least go have lunch or something.
Yeah.
And so then a while after that, Bob sort of calls me out of the blue. He's like, hey, I want you to come down to the shop and come alone. I thought, oh, crap. He's going to push me into the wood chipper, you know? What's like, I don't know what next?
What is it?
Like, this isn't going to go well.
The real story.
Yeah, this isn't going to. And so he, you know, he's like, can I get down to the shop? And he's pacing around. It's like, what's with you, you know? He lays out this whole plan. I went, I didn't see that coming. That's a little different than what I was expecting. And so we had to talk that through for a few months.
When would this have been in your years? Are you 20s?
Yeah, I was late 20s. Okay. I wasn't 30 yet. I was...
Bob said 28.
Yeah, sounds so
Bob,
about right.
Okay. Bob said 28 yesterday on record. Yeah.
Probably about right.
Yeah.
Trying to count back by birthdays and when our kids arrive.
Yeah.
I think about 28 is probably right.
So this is an impossible task, but give us the summary, because I want to jump into these electrics and I want to jump into the story.
Okay.
Give us, like, you have a, it's almost embarrassing to ask you to do this because I know how hard it is. What happened at Taylor to you and to Taylor, and just like, what did you learn there? Like, can you synthesize your experience, the stuff you've been right through, and what that did to you as a maker?
I learned there's a couple things that I could say pretty easily. One of them is that you need to be able to do extraordinary things with ordinary hands.
That's awesome.
Okay? Because up until that point, what I had done was, if I want something to come out better, that means I simply need to do a better job. You want your binding and purfling to come out cleaner, do a cleaner job. You want to try something that's really difficult, well, have another cup of coffee and take your time. You want to try, and you could simply just do a better job. Okay. Well, in a production environment, that isn't the option, because I can't sharpen a chisel and then have somebody else use it and expect that it's going to be used exactly the way I want. That means that I need to go, here's the result I want. I did it by hand. How am I going to execute this in a way that a person who may or may not know what the thing even does, could come in and have success first thing Monday morning and last thing Friday afternoon and have it come out the way that I want it to be.
Yeah.
That was hard.
That's incredible.
That was really hard. Yeah. Bob's very good at it because he was kind of born into like the industrialization mindset. And for me, that was a learned trait because I came at it as one person working on things.
You seem really natural at it. I mean, I've known you for 12 hours, but everything we're talking about, I've had to learn it too. You know, I've struggled with it so much with our assembly process and stuff. And then a big eye opener for me was Brian Ball is a good friend. And I went to the Ernie Ball String Factories and he literally almost verbatim is share. It's that thing of, we need to make like a million strings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I can't make a million strings.
How are we going to do that? Yeah.
And you know, then Bob, over 50 years, you figure it out. And it's like this weird fight of how to keep your process of the hand thing.
Right.
Like, how do you put that in anyone's hands? How do you put your hands in their hands? That you is such a challenge.
Bob said something this morning when we were chatting. He said, you spent 1,000 hours trying to use a chisel and he spent 1,000 hours trying to figure out how to put one down and not use it.
Totally.
That's really beautiful. I mean, it's
a good way to describe it because I was interested in accumulating, learning things so that I would know how to do them. So I would never not know how to do them. So like I got really into sharpening tools because I wanted to be good at it and I wanted to never be hindered by my lack of ability, going, well, I want to do this, but I don't know how to sharpen this chisel the right way, so I can't. It's like, well, just learn how to do it, and then it's not a problem, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of those things, they're learned habits, but you can learn anything that you want to learn.
Like, you got to want to learn it, though.
You have to want to learn it, and you have to put your time in. And my dad told me something a long time ago. He goes, you know, you should learn to love working because life is full of a lot of working.
Yeah.
And then you can learn to love, find something enjoyable about even like the chop wood, carry water parts of life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can be pretty happy with it. It's going to work okay.
Do you feel a sense of, in the world today, a loss of craft, like a loss of craft? I was at a festival and Nick Offerman was sharing about this thing that he makes furniture and all this stuff. And there's this interesting feeling with, are people learning hard crafts? And what's the importance of learning a hard craft? Because you've mastered a hard craft.
Well, I don't know that I've mastered anything, but thank you. I appreciate it. I think it's lost and found.
Okay.
At the same time. Because you see things drift away and you see people not learning things because it's an old way or it's an outdated thing. And yet when enough momentum starts to drift this direction, somehow almost spontaneously it combusts over on this side and you see the rise of it in some other way, because a lot of the traditional crafts, they're so fundamental to the human experience that when we drift far away from it, you start to notice that it's missing and it comes back in. Like in my own case, I really love growing fruit trees.
Okay.
One of the things I like doing.
No one does that in Kansas City.
No one does that in Kansas City. I'm by the coast. I can grow fruit trees year round because it never frosts.
Yeah.
So I got really into avocados and oranges. My mom always has been growing everything. And I like that. It is an absolutely terrible idea. There is zero commercial interest in doing something like that. And yet it seems so incredibly valuable and so meaningful to watch, put this thing in the ground and go, wow, look, the seasons changed. It did these different things as you went around. I get a tremendous amount of value out of that. Man. I've seen other furniture makers, other people become interested in building instruments, playing instruments. I mean, why in the world do we play music to begin with? Think about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This has very little function in our lives. it doesn't really give you that much back in terms of efficiency in your daily life. It doesn't really, there's a lot of things it doesn't do for you.
Our finances sometimes.
yeah, that happens. Except that without it, I don't know that I'd want to be alive because this is the thing that I use every, like literally every day to help make sense of the world that I live in. I want to be able to say something in a song that I can't say otherwise. I want to listen to somebody else tell their story in a song. I want to just hear the notes come out of this instrument and go, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's beautiful.
I love the stuff you're saying and it like resonate. I actually have never heard someone, there's little nuances you say, and I feel like I say them in my head all the time. I feel like I'm meeting my brain a little bit. There's this thought that I keep thinking about and trying to write about and kind of worm through. It's like the craft piece, whether that's music or making a guitar or a pedal or whatever, painting. There's this thing that I think the value in our humanity is that we are, beauty doesn't need a purpose. And the world right now is trying to put purpose on every single thing and make an algorithm decide if it's valuable. And it's like, so frustrating.
Yeah. Well, most philosophers like, over history are going to say that beauty is its own value.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm saying that it's countercultural to actually do the craft for the sake of the craft.
Yeah.
Because now we have a world that's trapped bands, companies into making a thing to make sure we're liked. That's not for the purpose of beauty. Mm. That's for the purpose of something that goes away in 15 seconds. And like, I think that's what the craft thing that's so fascinating. When I sit with someone like you, man, I want to learn what you've learned because the value of you've made beautiful things for the sake of making them. And that has changed your life and everyone around you. And that is countercultural. I think there's something about craft that is so important to the exploration and the wonder of just beauty and just that definition.
You know, it's,
this is turning like philosophical.
Well, it is, but a lot of playing music is inherently like an extension of your own philosophy.
Absolutely.
So like, well, you make these things and a lot of people get to benefit from them. They get to enjoy it. They get to have fun with it. And at the same time, you can use that to help the community around you in a lot of different ways. Like originally when Bob and Kurt approached me, the answer was kind of no. Like, man, I don't know that I can do that. And that's not really what I saw coming. And so we talked about it for weeks and weeks. And finally, Bob goes, well, I'm going to put it to you this way. He's like, working the way that you do, you can make a dozen people really happy every year. You can make a dozen musicians happy and their audiences. That. You could provide for your wife and your kids. That's great. I love that. Or you could take the things that you're good at doing and you can provide for these 1,000 employees whose livelihoods depend on producing these designs. Thousands of people around the world whose livelihoods depend on supplying materials for these things. Thousands of people around the world whose livelihoods depend on selling these things, let alone the hundreds of thousands of people who get to enjoy playing these things and all the music that they make.
That's a beautiful way
to say that. So what kind of context could
you use? How do you want to spend your talent?
Yeah, exactly. Who can benefit from it?
Yeah.
Because you're going to have an influence. You're going to have a reach in your local community, amongst your family, amongst your friends, and maybe it extends a little farther. But what good could you do with that? Yeah. What good could you do with that? And a lot of those traditional crafts, they play into this because you're looking at it and going, well, there's something inherently good about this.
Yeah.
There's something inherently beautiful about going through the process, learning about it, sharing. Yeah. It's one of the things I love with cooking. I mean, I couldn't think of a more traditional or like elemental aspect. Cooking.
Or delicious. Yeah.
Have you ever eaten a guitar? I've never.
They're good.
Yeah. Cedar plank salmon over a cedar offcut on the barbecue.
That's it.
Okay. There we go.
We are talking.
Is there like, Taylor should do tone flavors.
There it is. That's it.
It's like tone the flavor. Leftover Taylor Woods for your salmon for on cooking. The grill.
Oh, yeah. Some of them are really good. I kid you not. Western red cedar. You soak that thing for a little bit.
Yep.
Skin side down on top of it on a barbecue that's a little hot with a touch of brown sugar.
I'm getting hungry.
It's
now.
Really okay. good.
It is.
It's just a little bit smoky. It's lunchtime. You got to soak it first, otherwise it burns up too fast.
Yeah.
Dip it in water first. It's the jam.
Delicious.
Come to San Diego. I'll hook you up.
Delicious tones.
How long is this podcast? No one told us.
I think it's an hour.
Okay, so
it's a long form.
Let's Okay, everybody good? Everybody having a good time? Okay. Man, I could talk to you for hours.
I'm sure we will.
Yeah, we will. So there's Taylor, and like that story is wild, and I'm sure there's places to explore it if you're watching this and stuff. Let's talk about you purposefully entering the world of electrified guitar in the way that you have, and how did that happen? Of course, that's a 3-hour answer, I'm sure, but like, you have these, let's just call them like the little monuments in your career. Yeah. We're at one right now. I think the world, the thing about history and like as a researcher and someone who's constantly digging, it's really also important. And I kind of preach this. We need to notice what's happening now, because if we don't, we end up having in the future to go back and hunt it down. So
I'm not good at writing things down. So good luck.
Yeah. A part of, that these things like these podcasts are helpful. I mean, I dig and it's like just finding anything, but preserving the now is preserving history. Mm-hmm. So I think you're at a moment, you've made a guitar. That's impressive.
Thank you.
Talk about it.
I've always liked electric guitars. I grew up in Southern California around mostly surfing and playing music and hot rods and the whole Southern California experience, right?
I feel like the San Diego area is just like a movie plot.
It kind of is.
As someone from Alabama that now lives in Kansas City, it's like this weird mashup of like Grease and something else in my head.
And you know what? It's weird. Think of it this way. If you went like elementary school American history, you had that thing called Manifest Destiny where you're moving across the, start on the East Coast.
Oh, yeah.
All the freaks and the weirdos keep getting pushed further west. They all landed on the West Coast, and there was an ocean, so they couldn't go any farther. Okay. So we all live there,
You're the corner of the room. Yeah.
Kind of.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And so I sort of grew up like in the mix of all that, because everywhere you look, there's, some hot rodder, some architect, some artist, some songwriter, someone who's doing something interesting. And so I grew up around all those influences, but I always loved electric guitars. That was kind of what I was really into when I was a kid. I loved the ventures. I still love the ventures.
What was your first electric guitar?
I had a Squire Strat. It was used. It was not a great Strat, but it was mine.
It did it.
I liked it. Because it was mine. it's not great, but whatever. So I had a lot of guitars, and I'd get one, I'd play it, I'd go, nah, not that one. I'd build one, nah, that's not that. I'd work on one, I'd go, I kind of like this, the way that this part works, the way that part works. I'd listen to a new record and go, how'd they make that sound? What the heck was that? And so I never really had what I wanted. At a certain point, I went, I've collected enough of these thoughts over the last 30 years. I could just build what I really want. And so in a way, it came out of COVID. You see a lot of people exploring their COVID projects. I've got some cool archtop guitars that I built for myself that I love, because that's one of my real love languages with guitars, archtop guitars. I really love to build the electric guitar that I wanted, because it never really existed. And yet if I lived where I live now, let's say back in the development era of electric guitars, and it's inherently a Southern California thing. You look at Les Paul, Leo Fender, Paul Bigsby, Doc Hoffman.
Beecham, all of it.
All of them.
All of it.
They're like within, a 10-mile radius?
Yeah.
Most of them knew each other. So if I was there, what would I have built? Then, knowing what I know now, there's no parts catalogs to buy stuff from.
I did the same thing with pedals. I've done the same exact right? thing. It's like a role play sci-fi movie in my head. And I go, if I knew everything now, what would I do? Huh. I made a series of pedals based off that. Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so fascinating. But
it's like you go through this mental checklist to go, well, none of the, I can't go to like All Parts or Stu Mac or something and go, well, I need a this and a this and a this and a this. And I put together a parts caster. I put together a Telecaster. I put together a Les Paul. But what would I have wanted it to be? And so I started putting all these different things that I'd thought about for years together. It's like, well, I would have done this and I would have chosen to do this and I would have done this. And when I like playing pedal steel and lap steel. Okay. Well, when I move a bar, I get to move a whole chord and it maintains relative pitch. I'd love to be able to do that on an electric guitar. I mean, I know we could do it digitally with a pedal and all that, but I'd really love to be able to do that. I'd love it if this worked this way. Like I've been playing with this pickup design for years, which was kind of interesting way to use the magnetic influence of aluminum to shape a magnetic field. You know, there's all this kind of stuff. I just went, man, if I put all of these thoughts together into one thing, that's a pretty cool thing.
So it's the possibility of all the adjacent stuff you had.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I like what you said because you, what do I want? What do I want? And I think in electric guitar history, that's the moments. That's George Beauchamp sitting there. The frying pan happens. That's Leo in the back during the war.
Les Paul with his log in the Epiphone factory.
All of it. That's. I mean, the names are endless, and I think it goes back to what you've made came from this wandering and permission to just not have a box,
right?
Like, and beauty for the sake of beauty ended up leading you eventually through a process of like, imagine all the stuff you learned at Taylor. I mean, you know what you learned at Taylor.
There's a lot of things.
You start letting it accumulate. And I think this is important for makers and young musicians and young artists. You want to make a guitar when you're 16 and be you. It's impossible. You need the possibilities of the process.
Right.
And like you've been led to this guitar almost.
Yeah. It's like you got
to feel like that where you were led to it.
Yeah. It's like you got to spend some time getting your chops up so that you can go back and do what you really want to do to begin with. It's like playing music. I've heard once in a while, I'll hear a musician say, well, I don't really want to learn the theory behind harmony because that'll limit my creativity. I go, you got it wrong. I'm sorry, you got it wrong. You need to know all these mechanics so that you can have tools at your chops. You have tools at your disposal.
Possibilities.
Go, actually, I want to put this, this, and this together because I like the way that these are going to work. I have to know what the rules are so I know when I want to break them on purpose.
Adjacent possibilities.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it's a good phrase.
My favorite.
That's new for me, but.
We'll start a band.
Yeah.
So what are... There's just so many moments, and we've named off the legendary ones. When you think about guitar, I think it's an interesting thing here to just kind of talk through. I'd love to hear your thoughts on your guitar is so impressive, just looking at it, holding it, and stuff like that. I have not plugged one in. I am about to. I've heard so much good stuff. You have those key moments. So we go back to, you know, the first electric, the Rickenbacker stuff with George. You have Leo. You have the Telecaster's Monumental, et cetera, et cetera. The guitar evolves off of the needs or the problems. I mean, the electric guitar itself is we can't hear it. It's not. It's actually being lost in these big bands. We need to amplify it. Where are we now? Because there's an interesting thing where I joke all the time. I feel like I could just have a Jazzmaster and be done. You know, guitar players, and I'm sure you're this way too, like, do we need another new guitar? It's a hard no, but a big yes, I think. Like,
How many pedals do I need?
Well, yeah.
Just one more?
The last thing the world needs is a new JHS pedal. And I think, you know, we've probably had this talk about, like, you turned me on the Supro amps.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. These are like,
some of those are really fun.
1960s. The Valco Chicago designs. Valco. Yeah. Right here, does Chicago. It get any better in a certain way? Can you really do more than a Telecaster can do? Can you? I like this. Anytime I see like the frictions or like the juxtapositions of like this situation, it means there's a cool chat. There's a cool talk. Yeah. Like, we don't need the thing, but we just said that beauty for the sake of beauty is amazing. creativity leads us to a place we didn't know we needed to be. And here you are with a guitar that's at this part in your journey that has happened to you almost out of you.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to cooking for a minute. How many flavors are there? How many different things could you taste?
Is it even
measurable? You could exist on just a handful of things.
Yeah.
And in a lot of places, well, you look at the culinary history of almost any region and the recipes, the things that they become known for are based on what grows there. Whether it was a certain, okay. some certain animals, some certain plants, some whatever it might be, that's kind of what you develop your cuisine around.
So the geography helps develop the taste.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's why you go to the Mediterranean, you go, well, you got a lot of this and a lot of that and a lot of that, and they get combined in a lot of different ways. But there's a certain sort of palette of flavors.
In Alabama, we had Spam.
Spam? Okay.
I'm really sorry. I've been there. There's a lot of other flavors.
There are. I'm joking.
Yeah. You got a lot of cool ways to cook different greens. But there's a lot of different flavors. And every time you try something that's different, it sparks. It's like it's the ignition point of a new creative thought. To go, well, I've heard a G major chord, but I never heard it quite like that. I think this one's going to take me this direction. And before you know it, the same old thing is not the same old thing. Yeah. And so there's this little bit of like catalyst that sounds or feels will draw out of a musician that takes you into a new place.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts to feel exciting. It feels like a thrill.
That is, I can speak to that, you know, from the build standpoint, all that goes into it hits someone like me, an artist who's playing guitar for a living. And then how does it make me feel? Like, how does it, what does it inspire? What sounds come out of it? That's all that I really care about. So I could use a very cheap guitar, but if something really cool comes out of it, I'm like, whoa, this is great. I love this little thing, this little, you know, Pig Nose amp made the coolest sound on the record. And, it, you know, that's so cool to me. And
yeah, it's like if you look at some of those Supro amps, they're not good. They really aren't.
You can't get them wet, like on the edge. They're
like seriously not good. Yeah. Except that in the right context, with the right guitar, in the right band, with a microphone magic. In front of it, you go, now what is that magic that's going on?
Oh yeah.
Right? So sometimes it's an old thing that draws that new flavor out. Sometimes it's a new thing. But we're looking for that little spark of inspiration that makes us excited and feel like we're kids again.
So tell me, with this guitar of yours, like what's your pitch is the bad word. I want to go put, tell me what are those sparks you hope that I see? What have you done there? Because there's intention. There's like decades of thought in this guitar. This guitar is not you didn't wake up and just like, you were like 14 probably when this started, right?
I mean, some of these thoughts go back a long way. Some of them are very practical things. Yeah. Some of them are literal fixes for things. I go, well, practically speaking, this goes wrong. And I would love it if it would have been designed this way so that I don't have this problem.
So what are those practical?
Okay, so fretboard shapes, things the way the bridge works, the way that it couples, the way that posts like the, okay, you look at this bridge, it's a very simple looking design. There's no moving parts. One of the things I was most proud of is the insert that actually goes into the body that the little bridge post threads into.
Like I would be familiar with a tunematic or something. Okay. Like that post.
Okay, so you got the tunematic post is one thing. The bushing that you press down into the body.
The thing that's...
that thing has been the bane of my existence on a lot of old Gibsons for a long time. Hmm. I don't like the way that thing works. I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't ever like it. In 55,
like
Gibson used a half-inch long version. Okay, in your TV Junior, Les Paul Junior kind of flavor, right? Yeah. That bridge within months was leaning so far towards the neck, you almost couldn't get the bridge to function because the vertically oriented knurls on that bushing acted like little knife blades that would cut into a pretty relatively soft piece of mahogany. So once you loop strings around this thing, because it's a front-loading wraparound bridge, it's going to pull all of that pressure towards the neck. The way they fixed it was they switched it from a half inch to an inch. So they just made it extend farther, which helped your leverage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But every single one of them is still leaning that far forward.
Okay. Digging into the wood.
Yeah.
As the wood grows and all that stuff.
Sheer string pressure against the thing is going to make it do it. It doesn't have enough surface area to displace it to not move. So I go, okay, I don't like that. I want one where those knurls are horizontal.
Okay.
You physically can't put that in. Okay. It won't go.
Yeah, it's counter. It doesn't make
won't,
sense.
Yeah. It won't work, but that's kind of what I want. And so I ended up designing and patenting one where it's those horizontal knurls are ever so slightly inclined so I can thread it in. Effectively, it becomes a thing that's drilled and tapped into the body. Wow. Every one of those coarse thread now seat themselves into it. It can't go anywhere. And at the same time, they become very easy to put in because I'm not pressing them in and trying to keep them aligned. They just thread in and it seats itself perfectly.
That's a great
idea. It can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, well, of course, this is how I wanted it to be all along.
Yeah. That's brilliant. What's another one more practical? And then let's talk about like some spice stuff, you know?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So one of the things that I don't know many builders think about, the length of string between the post and the backside of the nut matters. It matters on a guitar. I don't think many builders pay attention to it because it's a hard thing to calculate. It's a hard thing to control.
So you're saying from the bridge all the way to the machines?
The backside of the nut.
Oh, okay.
So the part that you don't play.
Yes,
got that's you. Between the capstan or the post of the tuner and the backside of the nut. Okay. It's dead space.
Sure.
You see some electric players tie a handkerchief around it. You saw, I think George Van Epps did his little mute.
Just cigarette holder.
Yeah, cigarette holder, those kinds of things. Okay, the resonance of that passive length of string actually matters. It affects the notes that you play on the guitar itself. And so there's certain spots on some guitars where, you know, you end up with this big long length of string, say between the backside of the nut and maybe the G tuner post. It's like 6 or 7 inches long.
Yeah.
And its frequency range at standard pitch is actually interfering with notes that you're going to play on the same string high in the fretboard. Mm-hmm. It makes all kinds of weird stuff happen. That's not good.
Wow.
It makes certain things sound okay and other things sound not okay. And so this headstock actually designed it by the mechanics of lengths of strings and angles and all that. And go, okay, well, now that I have this arrangement of parts all where I want it, I just got to figure out some sort of shape to draw around it that
looks okay. So you didn't cut a shape and then...
No, it was all
mechanics
first.
Which is what usually happens, I
guess. Yeah, it's what usually happens. Yeah. You go, I want something that makes a statement that looks good. I'll do that.
I saw a croc stock yesterday where they turned it upside down and it was the shape of a pair of crocs.
No. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in this building.
Was that I'd like to see that.
I wonder how resonant a croc shape is.
I couldn't tell you. Okay. And so there are a lot of things like that that are very practically oriented that you can explain it and that's fun.
What are some of the, then there's that other level and everything's going to be practical to you, I can tell. And that's good. But what are some things that are your things that you feel are just part of that wandering and beauty for the sake of beauty part of you?
I love the way the notes come out. Mm-hmm. I love the way the notes come out on that guitar.
And is that a sum of the whole to you?
Yeah, it's a sum of the whole. It's a sum of this neck being made this way with these kinds of all, like literally everything that could touch the string, hold the string, be around the string. All of it has a story around it.
Okay. Yeah.
But when the notes come out, it makes me feel like they're inherently musical notes. And so the sound of it has a voice. It's got this lyricism to it. And it's different than the other sounds I've heard. It's familiar, but it's not the same. And I can't get anything else to do what this does.
I'm so excited That's good. To play this.
I can totally agree so with pumped. That and affirm yeah. that. It's like, yeah. I feel like I like it a lot. Why do I like it so much? You know? And
yeah.
then you're like, well, it's because, oh, that's why. Yeah.
Yeah. There's lots of little things that all add up to go, this is a lot of fun.
That's really cool. Yeah. I think you've made, I just, what I've seen and looked at are just unbelievable. They're so cool. I think it's, there's always the fine line of like, make a new thing for the sake of it being new. And sometimes that just is a train wreck. I feel like history and purpose in what I see. And that's like a really special thing when a maker is making something that is respecting even the problems, like in a weird way. You have to respect that.
Right.
That Gibson thing.
Totally.
Because if you can respect it, you can figure out what's going on.
Something you said probably an hour ago now, I would not have had the thought that I had if they hadn't done what they did.
Exactly.
So if I hadn't watched this happen time and again, I wouldn't have thought that that was a thing that I should do differently than what was done.
Yeah, your guitar is an accumulation of possibilities that came from problems.
Yeah.
I like to think of things being made that way. It's really fun. It's been
it's exciting.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I think it's for people in here. Your problem is this beautiful process that you can turn into a thing.
Yeah, it's That's a space what you've to thrive.
Done really well. Yeah,
it's a space to thrive and start with something fresh.
Yep, I love it, man. This has been so fun.
Yeah, likewise.
Good. Thank you, Jack.
Cool.
Hey,
it's a blast. Yeah. Give it a hand.
All right, that was our interview. One of many sessions we're going to be sharing from the Fretboard Summit. If you like it, subscribe. If you really like it, leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts. Please share this show with your friends. And as always, you can reach out to me, podcast@fretboardjournal.com.